Almost 2 million lawful Venezuelan, Cuban, Haitian, and Nicaraguan migrants, most of them in Florida, are suddenly unlawful migrants subject to deportation. Or are they? Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, a panel of expert immigration attorneys is going to help us sift through that question and others that are haunting South Florida's immigrant-rich community. Because we know this community is especially confused and scared right now about just who falls under President Trump's sweeping and controversial deportation campaign. This week, for example, a federal judge seemed to offer TPS holders a hope of reprieve. But nothing is certain. Our conversation is coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. This week, a federal judge in San Francisco ordered a pause to President Trump's attempt to cancel temporary protected status, or TPS, for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan migrants, most of them in South Florida. TPS shields them from deportation back to crisis-torn countries like Venezuela, but the new Trump administration has moved to end it for more than a million Venezuelans and Haitians. Meanwhile, it now wants to terminate another lawful migration program, humanitarian parole, for more than half a million other Venezuelans, Haitians, Cubans, and Nicaraguans. All of this means that more than a million and a half people who held lawful immigration status suddenly find themselves unlawful, and now subject to Trump's epic drive to arrest and deport millions of undocumented migrants. So, is this week's court injunction a ray of hope for them, or is their eventual expulsion back to nightmare conditions like Hades inevitable? And if so, how can they now keep that from happening? Joining me are four respected immigration experts who work with those most affected communities here. Venezuelan-American attorney John De La Vega practices in Miami, as does Cuban-American attorney Elena Santana, former immigration judge Denise Slavin, senior advisor at the nonprofit Americans for Immigrant Justice, which represents many Haitians, and Nicaraguan-American activist Jarelis Mendez Zamora joins us from the nonprofit American Friends Service Committee. Welcome and thank you to all of you. Now, John De La Vega, I want to start with you because the news this week was obviously that TPS ruling in San Francisco. I want to play a little clip here of a video that a Venezuelan exile entertainer here named Leo Colina posted to Instagram after the judge halted President Trump's order to cancel temporary protected status for Venezuelans.
El TPS continúa lleno de preocupación, todo el mundo por montón, ya no sabía qué hacer.
So there's a little sabor maracucho for you, John. Colina sings there that TPS will continue. We all had a mountain of worries, but now we're going to raise a drink because TPS has returned. But John, is Leo celebrating a little too soon? What is the reality now for the almost 600,000 Venezuelans who have TPS?
Well, yes, and there's a reason to celebrate this week because at the beginning of the week, a federal judge granted the motion to postpone President Trump's decision not to extend the TPS for Venezuela, which these are excellent news. At this time, Venezuelans are still protected under TPS, and they can definitely file for the re-registration and also for to renew their work permit.
Yeah, and we should remind people that there are two groups of Venezuelans we're talking about. The first group, their TPS was going to end this month. The second group, their TPS is going to end in September, correct?
Yes, okay. Yes, Tim. So, but this decision is a temporary measure to protect the community. The U.S. government already informed us that they are appealing the judge's decision and litigation will continue. And I believe that the future of the final decision will be held at the Supreme Court. So there's still months or even years to come for us to find out the conclusion of this case.
Okay, and whatever the ruling, it will affect both groups, do you think, not just the group that was affected this month?
Yes, it will affect both groups. And like I said, the government is appealing this decision from the federal judge. And I think in the next weeks, we're probably going to have a decision on that appeal.
Right. And we should remind people what's at stake here is getting the TPS renewed for another 18 months, correct?
Yes, until October of next year, which, as you know, the country conditions right now in Venezuela, it's getting worse, and Venezuelans cannot go back safely to their country.
Right. Denise Slavin, the other big TPS situation our community is dealing with is Haitians, 500,000 of them who were told last month that their temporary protected status, which was supposed to be up for renewal in February of 2026, will instead expire in August and will not be renewed. Where does that situation stand? I mean, are we seeing the same sort of lawsuits emerging now that we saw bear fruit this week for Venezuelan TPS holders?
Yes, we are. And particularly there's in Massachusetts, there's a lawsuit pending Doe versus Nome, which is challenging termination of the TPS for Haitians. But interestingly, the judge in that case, the hearing is set for April 7th or April 10th, but the judge in that case noticed that a second amendment complaint had been filed in the California complaint, in the California case where TPS was issued against where an injunction was issued against terminating TPS for Venezuelans, to add Haitians to that lawsuit.
I'm sorry, a second amendment complaint?
An amended complaint had been filed.
An amended complaint. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, an amended complaint had been filed in the California case. And so that the judge in the California case basically gave, when he issued his order on March 31st, granting the injunction against ending TPS, he gave the parties until this Monday to decide whether they want to ask for the same relief for Haitians before him.
Okay, so do you see things moving in the same direction for the Haitians then that we saw it move in for Venezuelans this week?
I would hope so. I think they meet the exact same criteria that the Venezuelan case had in terms of the racial animus that was behind these actions and the failure to comply with the administrative procedures
and
necessary.
You're referring to the comments that Edward Chen, the judge in San Francisco, made, that the Trump administration was using some somewhat racist criteria in its reasoning for shutting off TPS for Venezuelans, correct?
Exactly. So if the judge in California is asked to address this also with respect to Haitians, I'm very hopeful that there could be a positive response and he would extend his restraining order also.
Elena Santana, TPS is not an issue for the Cuban community, but that doesn't mean the Cuban community doesn't have big immigration issues right now. Remind us what the biggest ones are, starting with all the anxiety about a form called the I-220A. How has that come to define the immigration anxiety gripping so many Cuban families here?
Definitely, Tim. The I-220A, or Order of Supervision, as it's formally called, has become a significant source of anxiety for so many Cuban families here in South Florida. Essentially, this form is given to individuals who are released into the U.S. instead of detained, but they're still in proceedings, and it often disqualifies Cubans from adjusting their status, as their entry isn't being considered a parole for residency under the Cuban Adjustment Act, which is usually what we see happen. Mm-hmm. This uncertainty, compounded by the fact that we're seeing people detained at regular ICE check-in appointments, leaves families in a constant state of limbo here in South Florida.
Jareles Mendez Zamora, there are far fewer Nicaraguans who have TPS. In fact, I think the total number is fewer than 5,000, correct? Still, their TPS is due to expire in July, and Trump is likely not to renew theirs either. But the big question is why Trump's predecessor, Joe Biden, didn't expand the pool of Nicaraguans eligible for TPS before he left office in January, as the Nicaraguan community had implored him to do. Why do you think he didn't, and where has that left Nicaraguan migrants now?
Yes, so you're right that the number of Nicaraguans who have TPS is tiny. It's only 2,925. And as advocates, we did everything we possibly could to convince the Biden administration to expand this pool. We did press conferences, wrote op-eds, we worked with members of Congress to release bipartisan congressional letters. We met with the White House, we met with State Department, we met with DHS, we met with the National Security Council. And I say this because I want to make it clear to listeners that we moved cielo y tierra. We moved heaven and earth.
Yeah.
We did it. And so you know, the Biden administration in the beginning told us that the number of crossings for Nicaraguans at the border was just too high. And then they gave us the runaround asking for more reports. Meanwhile, we were sending them reports from the UN around Nicaragua committing crimes against humanity. And we had high hopes when there was the release of the 222 political prisoners. So all signs were pointing to something positive. And what breaks my heart is that there are thousands of families that are now in this limbo because the Biden administration looked weak on immigration and they needed to do something. Yeah. And so good policy was thrown away for what they thought was going to be good political motives.
Now, far more Nicaraguans have what we now call humanitarian parole that was created by the Biden administration. So let's pivot from TPS to that question about humanitarian parole for Venezuelans, Cubans, Haitians, and Nicaraguans, which the Trump administration has also now moved to eliminate. I should point out, of course, that the parole was only supposed to last for 2 years with a work permit. And last fall, the Biden administration said that two-year parole would not be renewed for these people. So it's not like paroled migrants here were expecting to benefit from it indefinitely. But neither were they expecting Trump to cut it short the way he has. John De La Vega, again, explain to us why Trump's humanitarian parole decision has been such a jolt in that regard. Should we expect lawsuits on this too?
Yes, and I'm still shocked because I do not believe that the decision to end the parole program makes the United States safer, like the White House has been arguing or using as a justification for their actions. This decision leaves more than 500,000 people that came to the United States the legal way without any status and subject to deportation in such an abruptly manner, which affects not only them, but also their communities. So the question is, what is the government going to do with 500,000 people in the United States without any status? Are they planning on starting removal proceeding against them and collapsing even more the immigration courts? What are they planning on doing? And also, they are coming from countries that most of them cannot return.
Right. I want to get to that later. But we should also point out, when I say he cut it short, let's say that a person here received their two-year parole 2 months ago and was expecting to have that benefit for 2 years. Trump has said, no, I'm ending it now. It doesn't matter how long you've been here, right?
Yes, it does not matter if you've been here for a year and 11 months or you've been here for 2 months under the parole program. He only gave them 30 days to either leave the country or be subject to removal.
Right. Denise Slavin, in the minute we just have left in this segment, tell me how that decision has affected the Haitian community, which has actually the largest group of humanitarian parole recipients, more than 200,000.
I think there is a lot of fear and confusion within the community about what's going to happen with that. And I would suggest, I mean, we have open hours for people who can't afford attorneys that you could call at Americans for Immigrant Justice, AIJustice.org, if you want to be a consultation about that or consult an immigration attorney.
Right. Now, Elena Santana and Geralys Mendez-Zamora, I want to get to that question about humanitarian parole as it concerns Cubans and Nicaraguans as well. But first, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll return with our panel of South Florida immigration experts, John De La Vega, Elena Santana, Denise Slavin, and Geralys Mendez-Zamora, to help us make sense of the immigration storm our community is facing. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We'll be right back. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. I want to welcome back our expert panel of South Florida immigration experts, John De La Vega, Elena Santana, Denise Slavin, and Geralys Mendez-Zamora, who work with the communities here most affected by President Trump's immigration policy hurricane, including the Venezuelan, Cuban, Haitian, and Nicaraguan diasporas. Elena Santana, I want to come back to you to that issue of humanitarian parole that we were just discussing in the last segment. What about Cubans who have have also availed themselves of the humanitarian parole in very large numbers. Is this a golpe, let's say, a blow to them as well, especially those who thought they'd have more time to benefit from it?
You know, Tim, of course, it's a huge blow. The situation with humanitarian parole has indeed been a significant concern for the Cuban community. Many Cubans have relied on humanitarian parole to enter the U.S., expecting it to be a pathway that offers some stability. Some are just, you know, biding time, and so they have a more permanent solution. They anticipated having more time to adjust status and become green card holders. But now, without this designation, they face a lot of setbacks, including potentially remaining unlawful for the time they're waiting to qualify, not being able to work lawfully, things like that, that really call into question their future here.
Mm-hmm. Jalaliz Mendez Zamora, as we mentioned, Nicaraguans largely did not have the TPS option that these other migrant nationalities had. So did the humanitarian parole become an important option for them? And if so, how are they reacting to Trump's aggressive move now to cut it short for them as well?
It absolutely became crucial for Nicaraguans to have this humanitarian parole. 93,000 Nicaraguans benefited from this, and the majority of them came actually here to South Florida. We are the state with the largest Nicaraguan concentration, and there are thousands of families right now whose future is uncertain, who feel ungrounded, who feel scared, who feel lost, because suddenly everything has changed around them.
Do we know how many Nicaraguans did take the humanitarian parole benefit?
The number is 93,000.
93,000, okay. John De La Vega, then, the big issue now is whether or not TPS or programs like it continue. These migrants need to find ways to adjust their status, as Elena just pointed out, to something longer lasting, something that's not so vulnerable to the immigration policy whims of the White House. So one of the big complaints I've often heard, John, in the Venezuelan community from Venezuelan leaders, for example, is that the Venezuelans who did have these temporary benefits like TPS and humanitarian parole simply didn't do enough in the interim to adjust their statuses. What, in this case, from where you sit, what should these hundreds of thousands of vulnerable Venezuelans be doing now to correct that?
And I've always said that TPS and the parole programs have many benefits, but they do not create a path to residency.
Yeah,
I believe that if they're protected under these programs, they need to be proactive and find different ways to be able to stay legal in the country. And of course, a recommendation is always to consult with an immigration lawyer, not an uncle, not a cousin, nor a neighbor, an immigration lawyer.
And not a notary, which in Latin America, so many people often think are lawyers, right?
Yes, because you need to analyze if the person has viable alternative to be able to stay in the United States and to make sure that they don't make rush decisions that can end up in deportation. So that's the recommendation that I have for the community, and I hope that they take action as soon as possible.
But what is the channel that they should be direct? I often hear asylum, but are there others that they can be looking at to get themselves, as you say, on that path to legal residency that TPS and humanitarian parole did not offer them?
Well, each case requires a case by case basis, but you first need to analyze if there's some type of family petition available to them, some work visas. If they're afraid of returning back to their country, maybe asylum is an option. That's something that they need to talk under confidentiality with their attorney.
Okay. Denise Slavin, same question to you regarding the Haitian community. Have we seen enough Haitian TPS and parole recipients start adjusting to channels like asylum to avoid the deportation they're potentially facing in the months to come? And if not, what's being done to ramp that up?
No, unfortunately, I don't think we've seen enough of that. I mean, there are injunctions on or lawsuits with respect to both humanitarian parole and temporary status. But yes, people should be looking for a more permanent status. And if they can look into asylum, into employment-based, into family-based visas. And there's different types of visas. Temporary protected status has been in effect since 2010 for Haitians. If people have been here 10 years or longer, there's also provisions that they could apply for to remain in the United States. So yes, you definitely need to consult an attorney. And again, with Americans for Immigrant Justice, AIJustice.org, we have consultation hours that you can sign up for if you can't afford a private attorney.
Elena Santana, now that Cuban migrants find themselves not as able to take advantage of immigrant benefits like the Cuban Adjustment Act that you mentioned earlier, what other avenues are they now having to learn to pivot to so that they can get back into that, you know, rumbo or path, as we would call it?
They're pivoting to lots of other avenues. Some include things like what John mentioned, a seeking asylum where they must demonstrate a credible fear of persecution. Many are exploring family-based visas if they have relatives who are in the U.S. And that are citizens or residents, using waivers often to overcome certain grounds of inadmissibility, like an unlawful entry if they don't have parole. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these processes are lengthy, often take years to resolve. Some are exploring employment-based visas, though those also require some really specific qualifications. And, you know, navigating these varied pathways is crucial for them to find a stable future. And as John said, I couldn't emphasize more that the most important thing is to reach out to a reputable immigration attorney to discuss options and really figure out the best course of action for each individual.
Well, thanks for hammering that home, guys. Jadalys Mendez-Zamora, what about the Nicaraguan community? I've spoken to many Nicaraguan migrants here in recent months who are in a real limbo. They came here too late for Nicaraguan TPS that was established in the 1990s after Hurricane Mitch. They came here too early to receive humanitarian parole. What are the challenges of getting immigration status adjustment for this particular group?
Like you said, it definitely is extremely hard for Nicaraguans to figure out a path forward. But like so many of my colleagues have said, right, to consult with an immigration attorney, there are amazing organizations here in South Florida that are doing that work, like Florida Immigrant Coalition, FLIC, AIJ, Catholic Legal Services, that people should and need to connect to. I will say that I was looking at numbers for asylum applications for Nicaragua, mm-hmm. and less than 35% have had their asylum applications approved. So we know that this, again, is a pretty small number. Mm-hmm. But people, you know, to our listeners, please don't lose hope. Consult with an immigration attorney. See what other ways you can adjust your status. And yeah, that really to connect with those immigration attorneys.
Because they are in a better position than if they were just trying to come over the southern border right now. They have been here, like in the case of parole, for 2 years, let's say. They've sort of established themselves in the community. Does that make it easier, let's say, for them to get immigration attorney help and find those new pathways?
You know, in terms of finding new pathways, it all depends. It's the answer that nobody wants to hear. It's the answer that leaves people so unfulfilled and still so worried. But again, it all depends.
Mm-hmm. John De La Vega, just quickly, I also wanted to get a sense from the four of you if this recent wave of agreements between federal immigration authorities and local police in Florida to seek out undocumented migrants here has added a layer of fear in the community that perhaps wasn't there before. I would imagine, for example, the recent deportations of Venezuelans accused of being gang members, you know, to El Salvador has added to that fear.
Absolutely. And at this time, the Venezuelan community has seen many drastic changes in the past 3 months. The White House is trying to end TPS, revoke the parole, and also implement the special program, the Aliens Enemies Act, against Venezuelans to remove them and send them to a maximum security prison in El Salvador without the chance to see an immigration judge. Yeah. So this definitely is making the community very anxious. And we are worried that the local police here in Florida start using any justification for simple tattoos like we've seen in the past,
yeah,
just to refer them to immigration services and for them to be sent to another country, to El Salvador, where they can also be in danger. So, yeah, they're definitely wary at this time.
Yeah, and the tattoos you're referring to, the ones that federal immigration agents here have determined are a favorite of the, quote, you know, Tren de Aragua Venezuelan gang, but which are tattoos that are popular among the whole population in Venezuela. So it seems, yeah, a little difficult to discern. Denise Slavin, what sort of added anxiety have these so-called 287G agreements between federal and local law enforcement brought to the Haitian community? I see, for example, that your organization, Americans for Immigrant Justice, joined the American Civil Liberties Union this week in a federal lawsuit against a Florida bill that would even allow local law enforcement on its own to imprison undocumented migrants.
Yes, that Florida bill actually allows people, it has to deal with making a crime for someone who does not have a lawful status to enter or attempt to enter Florida on that basis, as well as some other, it criminalizes certain acts of just being an immigrant, basically, or undocumented immigrant. So it has provided a lot of unease. And we're part of a rapid response network that has a hotline people can call if they are subject to one of these enforcement actions where people are just being picked up off the street and disappear for a period of days until they're finally located in a detention facility somewhere. So it's been a very frightening situation for everybody.
Alina Santana, again, we used to think Cubans were somewhat immune to this sort of thing. And then last weekend, we see the story of a Cuban migrant in North Miami being whisked away by agents while he was taking out the trash.
Yeah, you know, Tim, the recent incident in North Miami is a stark reminder to everyone, I think, that no group is entirely immune to immigration enforcement actions, even in communities that historically might have felt more secure, like Cubans, who have always had what many call special protections. The situation really highlights the shift towards stricter enforcement policies and procedures that really affect anyone who lacks proper documentation, regardless of their nationality. It's truly a wake-up call for the community that legal status is increasingly crucial, and relying on historical exemptions or leniency is not a safe strategy. Yeah. And I've seen community reactions range from shock to mobilization, which is amazing as people have come together to support many who've unexpectedly been targeted by these actions.
Jadalys Mendez-Zamora, in the 30 seconds we have left in this segment, do Nicaraguans also feel more targeted now because of these local police agreements with the federal agents?
Absolutely. There's a lot of people in my community that have let me know that they're scared, that they're terrified, that they have no idea if they're going to be driving their children to school, they're going to be stopped, and then they're going to be separated from them. This is also a state that has passed SB 1718, that passed anti-immigration policies during the special session that the governor pushed for.
We're going to take another short break here, and we'll return with our panel of South Florida immigration experts, John De La Vega, Alina Santana, Denise Slavin, and Jadalys Mendez-Zamora, to help us make sense of the immigration storm our community is facing. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. We're back with our expert panel of South Florida immigration experts, John De La Vega, Alina Santana, Denise Slavin, and Jadalys Mendez-Zamora, who work with the communities here most affected by President Trump's immigration policy hurricane, including the Venezuelan, Cuban, and Nicaraguan diasporas. In the last brief segment we have here, folks, I want to step back with the four of you and remind people just what sort of conditions these migrants would be returning to if, in fact, the Trump administration is able to render their status unlawful and to deport them. Because at the end of the day, that's really what this is all about. John De La Vega, let's start with Venezuela. What is Trump getting wrong, in your opinion, when he claims that it's okay now to send Venezuelans back to that brutal dictatorship, which has now agreed to take them back, and to what is still the worst humanitarian crisis in modern South American history?
Well, and just because Venezuela has agreed to take deported Venezuelans back, that doesn't mean that it's safe for them to return. We still, like, there's still country conditions that show that there's a brutal dictatorship right now responsible for human rights abuses, arbitrary detentions, torture, and political repression. They have completely neutralized the opposition in Venezuela.
Right. This is a dictatorship that stole last summer's presidential election.
Definitely, yes. And there's the problem here is that the White House is putting their statistics on deportations, on removal flights, before human rights to make sure that these people are being deported. They receive their human rights are respected, and they get to their country in a safe manner. So I think this is not a good policy, and let's see what happened, of course, with President Trump.
Denise Slavin, in recent weeks, we've been seeing little out of Haiti except reports that the capital, Port-au-Prince, is about to fall completely to the powerful and violent gangs who are, frankly, the de facto government of that country now. What should people know most, in your opinion, about the risks of sending possibly 500,000 Haitian migrants back there?
It is basically signing a death warrant for many people to send them back to Haiti at this point. The siege conditions there, the violence that is rampant there, the dire food insecurity, is all of the political violence and gang violence is one thing, But in addition to that, the climate change and natural disasters that have hit Haiti time and time again, just more recently, torrential rains that resulted in destructions of homes in about 2 years ago, those things are not going to be decreasing. All of these things make an incredibly perfect storm for to make it dire to send thing. And then plus we lose these people's contributions to our society, the taxes they paid, the jobs they fill.
As you pointed out earlier, some of them have been here since 2010 after the catastrophic Haitian earthquake of that year.
Yeah, there are soccer coaches, our landscape people, our hotel workers. I mean, they're people who have supported this economy, and we need them.
Right. And the UN points out that more than a million Haitians in Haiti have now been displaced. They're homeless because of the gang violence. Would Haitians who were deported back there simply become part of that displaced community, do you think?
Oh, I'm certain many, many, many of them would, and many more might end up being displaced, and many more dying because of the, you know, the... just adding a million people to this situation. I mean, adding 200,000 or up to 500,000 people.
More than half a million, yeah.
Yeah, to this situation is just going to make it even more dire. The chances for food insecurity and disease and apart from gang violence, it just would make an extremely tragic situation.
Right. Elena Santana, let's play a little of a new song that's out by the popular and now exiled Cuban singer Aide Milanés, the daughter of the late Cuban musical star Pablo Milanés. The song's called Duele, or It Hurts.
Ay, mi vida, no sabes el tormento.
Like Patria y Vida, this is just the latest musical lament about Cuba's economic collapse and political repression. So, Elena, how does the Cuban community feel about potential mass deportations back to the island?
You know, Tim, that song resonates deeply. It really captures the pain of Cuba's current economic and political turmoil. And the prospect of mass deportations to the island in this context is met with truly profound concern and fear by the community. Many fear for their safety and the potential loss of the freedoms they have found in the U.S. The community is acutely aware of the harsh realities they could face upon return. They could be jailed. Many were. And it feels their desire to find stable legal pathways to remain in the U.S. It's really not just a legal issue, as everyone has pointed out. It's a human one. It's deeply intertwined with emotions and fears of people who have been longing for security and freedom for so long in this community.
Do you have any relatives still back there or family or friends, Elena?
I do. Yeah, definitely do. Absolutely.
And what are they telling you about conditions there?
The conditions continue to be the same or worse. There is, as Judge Slavin said, there's, you know, food instability, obviously complete economic instability, just all of it. It's such a mess.
Jaralys Méndez-Zamora, when it comes to Nicaraguans, the dictatorship there might not even take them back. But if it does, are they almost certain to be treated like the traitors the Ortega regime calls them all the time?
If there's one thing that I've learned, it is to take serious the threats that the Ortega Murillo regime makes. We've heard stories about people not being able to board their flights, that they're stopped at their airports.
Yeah.
We've heard people that aren't allowed to get into the country, right, where they're stuck in the airport.
Because as punishment, he's essentially said, oh, you want to leave Nicaragua? Great, I'm going to take away your citizenship.
Exactly. So that's something that we've also seen with the 222 plus political prisoners, that they are desterrados, that they are taking their citizenship away, and now they're left as stateless people. And I want to read a little bit from the 2023 country reports on human rights practices from Nicaragua that the State Department released. Mm-hmm. Because again, something that somebody told me once when I was starting this campaign for the TPS for Nicaragua, they said, well, nobody even knows what's happening in your country. It's poor and little, so nobody cares. Mm-hmm. And so significant human rights issues include credible reports of arbitrary and unlawful killings, including extrajudicial killings, enforced disappearance, torture, or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment by prison guards and parapolice, harsh and life-threatening conditions, serious problems with the independence of the judiciary, political prisoners, and transnational repression against individuals located in another country.
Yeah, no, and we've seen, as you've just said, all of that, in the especially since 2018, when there were protests and Ortega started clamping down, his security forces killed hundreds of people. So yeah, this all resonates.
Exactly. We're in April, and so they always commemorate, the diaspora commemorates this month as one of the months where the people rose up and were killed.
Now, for the four of you, in just the 2 minutes we have left here, I also wanted, lastly, to just bring up something that happened yesterday. President Trump's emissary, special emissary for Latin America, Mauricio Claver Caron, was here, and he made the suggestion, and I want to ask just all of you quickly what you think about it, the suggestion that the reason the Trump administration is clamping down on immigration and sending these people back to Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Haiti, etc., is as a form of pressuring these regimes, to undermine the regimes. John de la Vega, let me start with you. Do you consider that a valid reason for what the Trump administration is doing? Is this really going to pressure these regimes to somehow back off?
On the contrary, the Venezuelan regime is using it as a leverage to be able to negotiate the oil distribution. So that's what I think that's happening. I don't think it helps the democracy in Venezuela, and I think it's not the right approach.
Elena Santana, in Cuba, do you see the Cuban regime somehow feeling pressured if the U.S. sends massive, you know, amounts of Cuban deportees back to the island?
No, not at all. I don't think this will change anything in Cuba specifically.
Uh-huh. And Denise Slavin, what about Haiti? I mean, you really don't have a government there, as I pointed out earlier. You just have gangs. Is that going to, sending 500,000 Haitians, going to do anything to pressure the gangs to back off from their violent agenda?
Just the opposite. I just think you're adding fuel to a fire there by sending people back to that situation with the regime in almost a state of
and
collapse.
And Jean-Elise Mendez Zamora, what about Nicaragua? Would that pressure Ortega at all if he were to have to receive these deportees?
Not at all. I think it would just add to his sadistic pleasure of making people citizenship-less and stateless.
I again want to thank our panel of South Florida immigration experts, John de la Vega, Elena Santana, Denise Slavin, and Jean-Elise Mendez Zamora. Best of luck to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.